Hi and welcome to Matrix Moments. This is Saloni and joining us today is Dana Stalder, partner at Matrix Partners. Dana is in conversation with Vikram Vaidyanathan, Managing Director at Matrix Partners India. And through the course of this episode, they cover Dana's journey into the venture capital world, his learnings from his investment in Afterpay, an Australian company focused on the buy now, pay later model, the market dynamics and evolution of the BNPL space, Dana's advice to Indian founders starting up, and much more. Tune in.
Welcome to another episode of Matrix Moments. I'm super excited to welcome my partner from the West Coast, Dana Stalder. Dana has been with our West Coast office for the last 12, 13 years. Dana might have that number off a little bit. I'm going to introduce you through the highlights. Early years at Netscape, eBay, that sort of gives away how old he is. and spent a good part of his time at PayPal. And at PayPal, he was SVP, headed product, sales, marketing, tech, which sounds like just about everything, and became a VC around 2008. He's led a bunch of our investments in Zendesk, EarnIn, Point, and most recently Afterpay, which is probably the largest fintech outcome in recent times, with a reported value of $29 billion. So welcome, Dana. Super excited to have you here. BNPL is, of course, a huge, huge topic of discussion. And you're sort of the original BNPL OG. So I'm really looking forward to this.
Good. Glad to be here.
So Dana, maybe start with a little bit with your journey. And, you know, when I went back to some of the old articles about you, you were pretty much offered every operator role. And you chose to be a VC. And what... Yeah. prompted you to make that decision? And the extension of that is, how much of that is true? Why do you continue to do this? Why do you want to do this for the next foreseeable future?
Yeah, I my career journey in general, I'd say, has been, is kind of foundational as serendipity more than anything. I've done finance roles. I've done many product management roles. I've done some quantitative marketing, and I've done a lot of general management. I've had one of these careers where it was not well plotted, and my each turn in my journey turned to be unplanned and unexpected. So I guess the common thread is I've worked with a constant set of people through my career. So I've kind of been pulled into new opportunities along the way. Venture capital is one of those as well. I mean, I ran a startup with two friends. We had raised lots of venture capital. I had been recruited as an independent director onto a Series A private company early in my career, and kind of sat as an independent director on that company all the way through the IPO process. And so had a lot of exposure, both raising capital and sitting on boards. And, you know, I had a few opportunities to join venture capital firms along the way. It was never the right team. It was never the right time. And I started having a discussion with the Matrix team, in 2008, I guess, maybe even late 2007. And it was a discussion that lasted a year, actually. So it was not a fast decision. So it was one I contemplated a lot about whether I thought I knew I would love venture, and it was something I had interest in doing from the perspective of mentoring founders. And I love the sport of company building more than anything. But I think it's really important to find the right partnership and team, because it is these venture firms are small businesses in the end.
I'm going to pause you a little bit. And if you had advice for sort of young aspiring investors, VCs, on top two qualities that they should sort of imbibe in themselves, what would they be?
Yeah, I've been asked this before. I don't know that I have great advice. I think here's my thoughts. In this day and age, I think it's different than when I joined venture 12 years ago. It's extremely different than if you had joined venture 20 years ago. I think nowadays it's a competitive category. You need to have credibility and you need to have an edge. So, you need to have achieved something in your career that is going to make you competitive in what is probably one of the most competitive businesses on the planet right now. So that can be being a founder that has achieved some success as a founder. It could be as a product leader in a successful organization and playing a role, a critical role in the success of that organization. Those are going to be the most obvious, and they're much easier said than done. I appreciate.
And today, when you look at why you do investing and why you love investing, how would you articulate that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit, as I indicated before, I love company building more than anything. I love building teams and leading teams. I love mentoring people. I think for me, venture had all these things that I'm pretty passionate about, and have, you know, it's a little bit like do what you love, which I say to my my kids all the time, and I think is an important kind of guidepost in life. And so for me, I just feel lucky to do venture because it has all this. I love setting strategy and figuring out how to win in a situation and watching that strategy play out and work sometimes and doesn't work sometimes, but, you know, and then you redo the strategy. But I love it.
So, you know, I get asked this question as well. And for me, it's the constant challenge of reinventing yourself every couple of years in order to stay relevant, which works for me because I'm highly curious. I just want to learn about what's new in the world, what's making people tick. And it's one way in which you can stay at the cutting edge of technology. I'm hoping I can invest in flying cars 20 years from now. And this is a great way to stay young and stay relevant. So
hey, there's a couple flying car companies raising money right now, Vikram. You don't have to wait 20 years.
I did make the trip up to YC a couple of years back, and I realized I didn't understand anything they were saying or doing, except that it was based off of LiDAR. So I invested in a LiDAR startup instead.
All right, it's probably a safer path. Yeah, or a better bet.
So switching gears to Afterpay, how did you get interested in the BNPL space? And this was very early days. So BNPL space, then got interested in a Australian company, which was public. Then it was a very, very unusual deal. So talk me through that entire process.
Yeah. So so I lead up the fintech investing at Matrix in the US. And so I spent a lot of my time looking at all the key trends broadly in that category. The core of fintech has traditionally been payments and credit. That's where I've spent a big chunk of my career before Matrix and also leading investments while here. So I was introduced to Nick Molnar and Anthony Eisen, who were the co-founders of Afterpay, actually by a gentleman who used to run PayPal Australia. And he worked on my team. He had built a relationship in the local Sydney tech market with them. They were, call it 2.5 years into running that business, and it had been an explosive start. I mean, this is a company that really ran quickly from day one. They were starting to think about expanding outside of Australia. And this fellow that I worked with said to them, hey, you really should talk to Dana because he ran the international playbook at PayPal, which I did. So I spent 5 years at PayPal as the commercial chief running product sales and marketing there. You know, the core of the strategy we executed during that 5 year period was this was kind of from a sub 100 million of revenue to close to 3 billion of revenue in that 5 year window. But the core of it was two things. One, it was expand PayPal off of eBay aggressively into, you know, rest of internet, starting with SMB and then working up to enterprise merchants, but also globalizing that brand. So we expanded into probably, I think, roughly 15 countries in that 5 year time period. So I had I had experience doing it and I knew the playbook and I knew what worked and didn't work. So I met Nick and Anthony on it. They did a trip to the US to kind of explore this. They knew there were a couple of key things. They knew they wanted to come to the US, but they didn't want to be an Australian company just hiring a local US guy and setting up an outpost here. They really, from the beginning, wanted to build a best-in-class Silicon Valley tech company. They wanted to attract the best talent. They wanted to have a significant presence here, and they wanted it to work in this market because they knew, I mean, look, the US market is, you know, 5-6 times the size of the Australian market. So they knew it was a big prize. I had heard of Afterpay, but didn't really understand the story much. And Nick and Anthony came, we got together, they took me through their journey from founding, which is it's a great story. I mean, they are almost 20 years age difference, and they know each other because they were neighbors. Anthony lived on the same street as Nick's parents, and he had known Nick as this young guy that he felt was incredibly smart and high energy and insightful. And it had said to Nick, if you ever do something new and entrepreneurial and you want a partner, let me know. So as it turned out, Nick
I'm gonna pause there. I read somewhere that Nick and maybe the founding team had spent a lot of time in e-commerce, jewelry businesses, and so on. Coming from sort of like a non-payments sort of background help them, and what made them best suited to design something like Afterpay?
Yeah, so there's two key underpinnings to Nick having the idea for Afterpay. And frankly, having the idea for what would become an entire category globally. And the two things were, first, he ran an e-commerce site. He ran ice.com in Australia, which was an online jewelry business. He did that while he was a student at the University of Sydney, and he did it quite successfully. So he made generated a lot of income on the side. He got into jewelry because his parents had actually run a physical retail jewelry business in Sydney his entire life. So he grew up in a household that was a small business retailer. He became an online, he was a power seller on eBay in his early 20s. And he saw the need for some type of credit-like product. And in particular, and this is the other, the foundation to this whole business, the insight is for the millennial, for his generation of consumers. Because what Nick understood was that millennials don't like credit. They came to age during the 2008 crisis. They had lower trust in financial service brands than any generation before them. They were debit card users. They were not credit card users. And they came to age during a period of time where they had record levels of student debt. Their parents were losing homes during the financial foreclosure. They saw all the bad things that come from overextending in credit. So this was a generation that needed some kind of benefits of credit-like products without all the bad stuff that came with it. And he watched the innovation that was happening. It was, you know, there's retail point of sale players. There was Bill Me Later, which ultimately became PayPal Credit. There was Affirm, you know, which is obviously a successful public company today. But from his perspective, those were all traditional credit businesses. They were in the business of attaching unsecured credit lines to consumers and generating revenue by charging high APRs and revolving debt with those consumers. And in his mind, that's exactly what the millennial doesn't want. So Afterpay was about really giving the millennial debit card user credit card-like superpowers without all the bad stuff, without revolving debt, without high APRs. And that really was the key to this.
When you think of sort of ecosystem evolution, and I'll come to sort of where we are in India, do you think there are sort of enabling blocks as well as blockers that need to be there before you can have sort of a BNPL play. Like, this is the evolution of e-com. This is how much cards should be. This is how revolving debt should be. This is the evolution of payment gateways before you can have a BNPL platform play.
Yeah, look, I think there's different ways to get there, but for sure, one of the key enablers for Afterpay is frankly the same enabler that was for PayPal, which is the card networks, right? So PayPal was built off the back of bank card dominant Western markets, right? And when we tried to go into Scandinavia or Germany in my PayPal days, we struggled in those markets in spite of even having very successful. I mean, eBay Germany was probably the number two market for eBay at the time, but it was a market that didn't have very high card penetration. So it's the combination of having a robust e-commerce market and a card dominant society that makes it really easy to spin up those two examples at PayPal and Afterpay.
Got it. And what do you think is unique about Australia? And maybe there isn't, but it seems like that's sort of the birthplace of BNPL because it just exploded in Australia.
I think it was the founder. I don't think there's anything particularly unique about Australia. And this is why when I first met Nick and Anthony, I saw this at PayPal. When we extended PayPal around the world, it was very clear. If it had strong e-commerce growth and it was a card dominant market, the playbook worked. The merchant value prop was very consistent and high, and the consumer value prop was very consistent. And it didn't matter if it was France, Spain, Italy, the UK, Australia, the US, Canada. They really behaved the same. So when I met Nick and Anthony and we talked through what they were experiencing in Australia, I had extremely high conviction that this was going to work in the US and work in other Western markets. Because I had seen that consistent behavior.
Though I'm just going to push that a little bit. It seems like, you know, when I look at the number of cards in Australia, it's just sort of dipped very, very quickly, just as fast as BNPL has risen. Whereas that's not the case in the US. It's sort of flat. And so it's not like card spends have come down in the US. It's just that incremental spends, especially through the pandemic, have gone towards BNPL. Whereas in Australia, it just seemed like it's just shifted en masse towards BNPL. And I was wondering if it's just that maybe there was a trust deficit with existing players, or maybe there's something structurally there where BNPL just took off and it seemed like the BNPL players have just have more
trust.
No,
look, I think when you're building a payment network, there are tipping points. And those tipping points are generally oriented around acceptance, right? The number of merchants that accept a particular payment type. We experienced this at PayPal in the early days, and you're seeing the exact same thing play out at Afterpay. So I think what you're referring to, Vikram, is just in Australia, because it was a smaller market, you've got most of the population in a couple big metropolitan areas, they were able to reach that tipping point very quickly. I don't think it's going to be, I mean, the difference in the US market is going to be that there's just a bunch of competitors, but we may actually get to that tipping point faster. It just may be distributed across three players instead of one.
Fair enough. So brainstorm with me a little bit on India, and you know India a little bit. There's UPI, which is now everywhere. Especially through the pandemic, every single merchant as well as consumer is on UPI. So it's not a card network. There's UPI and there is also card networks. But there's only, call it 50 million users with transaction credit of some kind, right? Yeah. That's the penetration. Yeah. So it's very low penetration of transaction credit, and probably 200, 250 million users should get transaction credit. And so it's all going to be credit on UPI or some form of BNPL, which is actually going to reach there first before cards. So how do you think a market like that would evolve? Because I'm wondering whether we just leapfrog cards and we will never have cards, and we will have some version of BNPL transaction credit. Maybe a few people will have cards.
Yeah, so I guess I have two thoughts. I don't know enough about the India market to be dangerous. So, but there are a couple of things that I think are
important kind of foundational things to building a payment network. The reason, so UPI may in fact just be the equivalent of the card networks in Western markets. The reason they are important is because they're standardized and they allow you to create this frictionless onboarding and payment experience, right? So really PayPal and Afterpay are both completely built on top of the payment rails. And I don't know that either of those businesses would exist if it weren't for those kind of universal payment rails in those markets. It allows you to, there's trust. Those people who come into the card markets, they've been vetted by the card issuers. They've been onboarded. There is often settle systems that allows you to operate with lower risk, so you don't, which takes some of the risk of credit losses out of the system, and you can do it frictionless, right? So you can, if you think, every PayPal user and Afterpay user, the account creation happens at the point of sale with a card into the wallet, with a bank card in the wallet. Yeah. Right? That just means you can have thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of points of entry into this payment network. And because it's an existing system, there's a card in everybody's wallet, you can do it at a high velocity. So UPI may in fact be that for the India market. I think the other thing I want to separate, which I think is really important, is this BNPL, buy now, pay later, has become this broad term. They are actually not created equal. There's actually two very different systems underneath it, right? So traditional point of sale credit is about high average order value. How do we increase the conversion rate on expensive items, right? This is where Affirm was started. There is a reason that, I don't know what the current number is, but at one point when it went public, something like a third of Affirm's GMV was Peloton bicycles and Casper mattresses, right? That is, I mean, that form of point of sale retail credit has been around for decades, right?
And so the largest BNPL player in India on that cross financing model is Bajaj, and Bajaj is a huge company. They've done that forever on consumer durables, on sort of two wheelers.
So that's great. There's a place for that kind of specialty retail credit, and there are a lot of very big businesses that have been built off the back of that. I think what Afterpay has done is fundamentally different, though. The consumer has no ability to revolve debt. The consumer will never pay interest rate. They do not generate any revenues from consumer interest fees. They are about giving the debit card user credit card-like experience, the ability to pay off a $100 purchase over four installments every 2 weeks without all the bad things that, from a psychological standpoint, come with these credit products. And that's the core insight about why Afterpay has been so successful and has grown so much faster than everybody else in the category, and certainly faster than anybody who is doing the traditional high AOV credit-like products. So the question I would have for the India market is what is the equivalent? What is the mass market, everyday use, top of wallet product, which is generally not a interest-bearing unsecured credit line?
So today it is essentially a UPI app, and the UPI app is effectively your debit card. And that's the most used payment instrument by a user. Now, it's interesting that UPI is actually open architecture. So I could have bank X, but I could have UPI app A, which is being used to access my money in bank X. Mm.
Is anybody creating value off of UPI through that's funded by a merchant discount rate rather than being funded by consumer fees?
So far, the problem with the UPI is that, well, the good thing is that everybody uses it. The problem is that everybody is now coming to what's the business model, because it was just created as a public good where all the banks sort of bought in, and there's a very thin margin there. And so credit lines on UPI, which sort of give a UPI user that credit functionality is sort of where things are headed right now.
Yeah, which, and that's, I think that's the typical trend as you go towards the consumer fees first. So the question I have is, can you build a big payments brand, but one that doesn't tax the consumer, that provides the merchant higher conversion rates, higher AOV, and a big base of consumers that are loyal to that brand?
So let's talk a little bit about that. So far in India, it's been consumer durables and mobile phone being the largest category. And then it's everything else that you have in the home, TVs, refrigerators, and so on. Are there sort of categories where this works and sort of best suited for it? And I know Afterpay did a lot of fashion and lifestyle. And you know, do you see it going more towards health, travel? Are there categories that it works for, and are there categories it doesn't?
Yeah. So look, the after, if you study the Afterpay playbook, it's not a secret. And it was really the playbook that was, to Nick's credit, was the obvious path to go for him when he was starting this business, right? He understood that his consumer was the millennial. He did not need to satisfy the needs of every consumer. He needed to satisfy the needs of that millennial consumer. As he thought about the millennial consumer, he thought about, how do I actually hack acceptance? How do I show up everywhere that she is shopping online? It is about frequency rather than revolving debt. So for Afterpay, they started with fashion and beauty, and they started with that female millennial consumer. And I want to be everywhere she shops. So it feels like Afterpay is everywhere. It also tends to be the brands that there are the highest affinity, brand affinity to with that particular consumer segment. So you're affiliating yourself with brands that are frequented and there is high affinity for, there's lots of social sharing around. These are also the brands that have the most social presence in their marketing channels. So they really harnessed that and in the process built a big lifestyle brand. I mean, Afterpay in most respects really has built a lifestyle brand more than they built a payment network. And it's one of the things that I think is most interesting. It's certainly something that at PayPal, certainly my time into today, was never able to do. Those tend to be more utilitarian brands.
No, it's super interesting, and it's probably least understood, especially in the India landscape, how much of a lifestyle brand Afterpay is there. And at least outside in, I thought it was actually a category first choice. This is a very sharp consumer backwards choice. And absolutely, that makes complete sense. That's how you actually end up at a lifestyle brand. A category play would end up in a payments brand, in some kind of payments company. It wouldn't end up with a lifestyle brand. So that's super, super interesting.
In the way you saw in Vikram, I'll share a couple stories. If you go back to the very early days of Afterpay, what happened is you started seeing face groups pop up, right? Which literally there were Facebooks being created by Afterpay users called We Love Afterpay. And there were forums and discussions talking about all the merchants they wish would integrate with Afterpay. And then you saw haulers on YouTube and influencers on social media that are focused around fashion and beauty starting to just organically talk about Afterpay and how much they love Afterpay, you know, and it was the millennial consumer shopper. So it was, you just saw this momentum. And but the insight is exactly right. It's starting with the consumer.
No, it's just super interesting to actually figure out that the founder ethos was sort of consumer backwards. He had a very sharp consumer insight, and then everything sort of went from there.
Then your strategy becomes simple when you have that clarity.
Yep. So fast forward a little bit, and not Afterpay, but sort of where this BNPL utopia is going.
Yeah.
Do you see sort of vertical specific BNPL plays coming? You know, health, education, where there are sort of complex business workflows, B2B. We have a company called Off Business, which is sort of commerce come financing, but a part of that is a very interesting BNPL play. So I'm just seeing that there is almost like a verticalization of BNPL happening. Do you see that? And do you think that you would invest in something like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it'd be very hard for any new entrant, certainly in Western markets, to come into what I'll call retail buy now, pay later. I think between Affirm, Afterpay, Klarna, and then the big guys are going to come in with their flavor. So PayPal has obviously done their copycat now as well, called Pay in 4. I think that's hard. I do think there is room for vertical buy now, pay later solutions, I guess is the short answer. Because I think history would show that consumers do in fact compartmentalize some of this spend. So I think that may exist around things like rent payments or recurring bills. It may exist around healthcare. I think the card issuers globally have the most to lose by this trend, right? And I think that's where ultimately share is going to be taken from, is spend that might otherwise have ended up revolving on credit cards is going to end up going through buy now, pay later rails. So I think we should expect all of the global card issuers to come up with some flavor of it. I think their preference would be that it's card-based and it's universal and you use it across multiple categories. So I think time will tell how that plays out, but I do think there is room for vertical players in the near term for sure.
Going back to the difference that you were highlighting between POS-based financing and true sort of BNPL platform, and the way at least I think about BNPL platform, it has sort of many parts working sort of in tandem. First is a new purchase experience, including discovery, and there's convenient payments.
That's right.
And then there's affordability, right? And that sort of starts spinning with like a virtuous flywheel, and then you get these network effects. That seems like it is a consumer first play, and you can't have, maybe the issuers, some issuers can pull it off, but this is going to be sort of new companies which are embedded in sort of the e-commerce landscape or that vertical commerce landscape.
Yeah. I think, look, there's one comment you made there that I think is really important, and maybe we can extract that out a little bit, which is the point around discovery. Is it's also one of the least understood things about Afterpay is their most mature market is Australia, obviously. For merchants that accept Afterpay is generally their second largest referral source of traffic after Google.
So the consumer journey actually originates on Afterpay.
That's right. And the numbers are quite significant. So I think in a lot of respects, this is the holy grail of payment networks, right? Where the incumbents have never been able to figure this out, where they can actually truly drive incremental GMV to these merchants. And I think because it's a closed loop network, they have the integrations with the merchants, they have the integration with the consumers. I think this generation of payment network also has the ability to exploit data in a way that the incumbents, the Visa, MasterCard networks have been unable to do because they have this multi-tier distribution. There's processors, merchant acquirers, issuers. You don't have the data that you do in these modern digital networks. So I think that's very important, and that's going to create a big competitive advantage for these new entrant payment networks.
Now, this is going to be fascinating how this entire space evolves. And for me, one of the very interesting things about this is that this is one fintech trend where every market is almost evolving in parallel and sort of picking up things from each other. Because otherwise, India was 10 years behind China, maybe 15 years behind the US. Now we have our own networks, and now it just seems like everything's sort of happening at the same time in each market. Yeah. So this is going to be fascinating to see.
Yeah, for sure.
Where do you think when innovation moves this fast, regulation is not very far behind. So where do you think regulations going to end up? Is it going to get regulated? And is it going to be similar to what we see with the card schemes?
Yeah, so to be clear, it's already regulated. You know, Afterpay in the United States operates with credit licenses in all the, you know, all 50 states, or at least the states that require to operate with a credit license. So they do, and it's foundational to what they have built is a know your customer platform, anti-money laundering detection and prevention. So those things are, you cannot build a payment network without taking regulation seriously. I do think the banking lobby will continue to push for more regulation, because I think if you are a major card issuer, you are a big bank and you are saddled with enormous amounts of regulation relative to any fintech startup. So I think this tension around regulation, from my perspective, is less about what's going to happen with BNPL, because I think they already are regulated and they do fit into regulatory regimes in the countries they operate. But I do suspect the tension is going to escalate between the banking lobby and the big incumbents and fintechs broadly coming in and taking share from that. I mean, JP Morgan, the CEO of JP Morgan, has been very public about his point of view of this, where they just feel handicapped in terms of competing with startups. So I think that's going to be a bigger trend in almost every market.
So I'm going to jump topics now. Is there anything that you wanted to hit on your thoughts on BNPL or Afterpay that I didn't cover?
No, I think we covered them. You know, I think the only thing I would add is I think it will be interesting to see. Afterpay is obviously entered into an agreement with Square to merge companies. It will be interesting to see if there is more consolidation in the space on a global basis. I think the scale of that merger has the potential to create more consolidation in the category, probably earlier than people thought. But this is a category that's moving so quickly, and there's so much competition, and it's taking the prize is big. So I think I would be surprised if we don't see more consolidation around the world.
So talk a little bit about that. I wasn't sure if you wanted to go there, but if you look at sort of a consumer brand in payments like Afterpay, and you called it a lifestyle brand, and an acquiring network, are they sort of natural partners for each other? And is that where you think most consolidation will head?
Maybe. I mean, I would guess in some smaller markets, I think if there are BNPL copycats that have emerged in those markets, I wouldn't be surprised if incumbents try to absorb them sooner rather than later, where they may have let the small little fintech thing kind of go. I think in general, we're going to see a lot more fintech acquisitions over the course of the next 5 years. I think this is an industry that, you know, there were a handful of companies that had taken big share from incumbents, yeah, but the amount of capital that's gone in, the amount of innovation that's happening, and the potential disruption of profit pools on a global basis is significant. So I will be astonished if there is not a lot more M&A globally in fintech broadly.
I'm smiling because I read this article that you guys put up in TechCrunch, maybe Jan 21, which said 100 billion. Yeah. Of fintech M&A and outcomes this year. You guys accounted for about 29 of that 100. So I think you weren't very far off.
Yeah.
Our podcast, I think we in our notes, I'll actually drop a link to that article. Last topic that I want to talk about is, as Matrix US, and especially you, Dana, you've had great success with companies that have originated anywhere in the world. Zendesk, Canva, Afterpay, all of these companies were founded in different parts of the world.
Yeah.
And then you've had great success in sort of partnering with them and bringing them to the US and making them big household names in the US. So one, are there specific founders or founder traits that you look for on people who are able to make that transition? And second, what advice would you have founders, especially in the India SaaS ecosystem, who are all making that leap to becoming sort of in the Indo-US corridor from an India company into a US company?
Yeah. So we do have a good history of funding foreign nationals who have started companies in their own local markets and want to move to the US market. I think, so there's a couple of things I would separate. We're not active investors of Australian founders who want to build a big Australian company for the Australian market. What we are interested in is partnering with founders who want to attack the US market and actually want to relocate here and have a presence here. We have a lot of expertise in starting, building, and scaling companies. And, you know, so Zendesk, we met Mikkel when he was initially in Copenhagen. I met Nick and Anthony when they were based in Sydney. We certainly met Cliff and Melanie when they were based in Sydney. And at the time, actually, when we led the seed round in Canva, they came to us specifically saying, we want to relocate to the United States, actually, to go after what will be our biggest market. Now, in their case, they ended up staying in Sydney and are certainly on a path probably to become the highest market cap Australian-based company in the world in history. So we very much want founders who want to bring their product and attack the U.S. market and be successful here in the early. So we love doing that, actually.
No, and I'm hoping that, you know, we can work together as these founders go from India to the U.S. And I'm looking forward to that journey.
Let me qualify because I think I didn't exactly ask your question, actually, when I think about it. I think the advice I would have is if you're India-based SaaS company and you want to attack the U.S. market, I think one of the founders needs to be here. I think it's pretty hard to stay in India and just hire people.
Absolutely. Yep.
And expect that you're going to build a category leader. I think you gotta have a presence here so you can actually understand this market and the nuances of it.
And I think that pretty much every founder has understood, and especially through this pandemic, it hasn't happened as much, but as soon as people can travel, everybody's on a yeah. plane to SaaS tour and trying to figure out how they get to move. Dana, this has been just a fascinating conversation. You're just so thoughtful about payments, about fintech. I can just keep talking to you forever.
Thank you, Vikram.
And I'm hoping some of our listeners get to learn as much from you as I have. And hopefully Good. We'll have you back talking about something
else. Absolutely. Anytime. Thanks, Good Dana. To see you.
See you. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in. For more Matrix Moments episodes, you can head to www.matrixpartners.in/blog. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for more updates.